Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is going to discuss a topic which really has been the topic of several books in the past year, on all dealing with the state of American agriculture and the enormous changes that have taken place in the last three, four decades. And it seems like these changes have taken place. And as I think about it, as I've lived through this period, it seems like there's still not a lot of understanding about what's happened and why. I think this book today, the focus of our show today, will help provide a little more focus because it's a really good book. The author is here with me today. Her name is Sonia Trom Ayers, and the book is called Dodge County, Inc., Big Ag and the Undoing of Rural America. One of the books I mentioned that was a focus of a topic of our show was from Iowa. One recently was from North Dakota, and today is Minnesota, just across, not too far across the northern Iowa border. Sonia, thank you for being my guest today.
Thanks, Robin. It's nice to be here.
Well, let's just start out. Describe your farm, your background, and kind of give us a little story of where the farm is and your upbringing and how this story begins.
So our farm is in southeastern Minnesota. For those of you who've been to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, we're about 30 to 40 minutes west of Rochester, almost directly west of Rochester. I grew up on the family farm. Actually, this was my grandpa's farm, and he grew up on the original Trom farm, which is 2 miles south. My great-grandfather came to the United States from Norway in 1892, and then my grandfather, Elmer, he and his wife, Marie, settled on our farm 100 years ago, and then my dad, who was one of 10 children raised on the farm, my parents ended up buying the farm, and that's where I grew up. So there are 6 children in my family, and we've seen the fundamental change, like so many of your listeners who have witnessed and frankly didn't understand the change that we were witnessing in our home communities.
And this is an interesting aspect of this, again, that I don't farm, but I live out in rural Illinois. What type of grain? It was kind of a multifaceted farm. It wasn't focused on one thing, which is different from today.
Well, you know, during my father's youth, it was, it would have been things such as more small grains, oats, some beans. They had, beans and corn. And they also had dairy cows. When I was a child, we had dairy cows. You know, the cows had a name. Every cow had a name. We had a few pigs at one point in time. My mother had chickens. But today we have it's 760 acres. My father kind of slowly continued to build the farm. We have 760 acres. And today it's cash crop. So we're just corn and soybeans, rotation every other year. So corn and soybeans. So no animals at this point.
It sounds like the farm you describe back in years past is what most people would envision if you ask a vision of a picture of a family farm. That's it. But those really don't exist much anymore. What happened then, and when that really fundamentally changed your family farm in southeastern Minnesota?
Our specific family farm, or what happened around the neighborhood?
Well, yeah, around that area, yeah.
So, because our farm is the same basic operation that it's been for many years. I mean, I'd say for 40, 50 years, we've had the same basic operation, perhaps longer. But what we started to notice, the first swine factory farm or confined animal feeding operation was installed 1 mile north of our farm in 1993. And, you know, farmers really had no idea what was going on. But they started to see some of these factory farms. And, you know, it was looking back now I realize, you know, when you put a mall, when you build a mall in a metropolitan area, you look at anchors, like what are the anchors that are going to go into that store and anchor that new mall? And so, because that's how, and then you'd build out the other businesses, right, around the anchors. But it was the same thing here, but we just didn't realize it. So in the farming communities, they were anchoring these factory farms in different locations, starting in the early 90s. And my sister Shelley and her husband Dave farmed in Blooming Prairie, which is that's our hometown. And Dave and Shelley had pigs, and Dave farmed with his dad. They were independent farmers, which means they owned their own hogs. Dave would take his pigs to market at Hormel. Hormel has their world headquarters in Austin. That's just 15 miles from my home community. But Dave noticed that the wait times were getting longer and longer for the independents. They had to sit and wait 45 minutes to an hour to deliver their pigs because Hormel was giving priority to big semi-loads of hogs that were coming in from area factory farms. And again, they didn't quite understand what was happening. And so it was a ramp up. And then 1998 was basically the breaking point. And at that point, Dave and Shelley could no longer get their financing. They were essentially locked out of the marketplace, and they had to make a very difficult decision to either, you know, as Earl Butz would say, get big or get out. So they had to make that hard decision to either get out of farming or build a great big factory farm and be part of this corporate system that was coming into play.
What factors caused the growth of factory farms? I mean, you described your generational farm had some pigs, cattle, different things, grain, but these farms, you know, are the factory farms with pigs are totally different. What factors caused this, led to the growth of these, the beginning and the growth of these factory farms?
This was very intentional. It was very methodical. This was very strategic. And this didn't just happen, you know, this was all part of the plan to essentially restructure the marketplace by the multinationals working in concert with Farm Bureau. And so they used the Farm Bureau network in large part to install, these early, you know, the factory farms. And then as they kind of got them up and grow, you know, going, they would tell some of these other farmers that they were trying to entice, this is how you get started in farming. That's what these guys were told. They had no idea, a lot of these guys, what they were getting into, but that's what they were constantly told. This is how you get started in farming. And so, you know, farmers kind of blindly signed up their kids and, you know, got a great big factory farm loan, which leads me to the next part of it, which is, you know, essentially what happened too was we have government funding through the farm credit system. These are dollars that were originally intended to assist independent farmers, to keep farmers on the land. But we have used our funding mechanism to assist with this corporate model.
Was this caused by, like, I'm curious, because the wave of globalization happened, and were they doing this, at least some of them said, to better compete in the global marketplace? And did they locate near places like Austin that use those hogs, or was it just all over the place?
The multinationals, or help me understand your question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still trying to figure out why. I mean, they did this for some reason. Was it to help the forces of globalization as the global marketplace came into our economy more? Were they doing this to for economical reasons, to sell, to compete globally? Was there anything to that?
So the corporate mantra is always feed the world. They are not feeding the world. And if you look at the statistics, in 2018, the USDA, gathered statistics regarding the number of hogs. Well, guess how many hogs were produced in 2018? Like the exact same number that were produced back in the 1940s. So what's happened is that this model is not feeding the world, it's feeding the bottom line. And what has happened as a result of this corporate model, which is a pyramid scheme, is that we have concentrated power, we've concentrated market power. And that's the true agenda here, is to concentrate market power.
Are these placed near slaughterhouses like in Austin? And we've got one near where I live and other places to make them closer for efficiency type purposes, or are these factory farms spread out more?
They've been very strategic. If I pulled the data for you, or if your listeners are familiar with southern Minnesota, drive along I-90, the southern part of the state. There are three meatpacking plants: Austin, Minnesota, which is Hormel; Worthington, Minnesota, which is JBS, which owned by the Brazilians. And then just across the border in Sioux Falls, you have the largest hog meat processor in the world, Smithfield. I call that Hog Highway to Heaven. And another place to drive is I-35, from just get on I-35 through Iowa, and you'll see. It doesn't jump out at you at first, but when you're driving along Hog Highway to Heaven or on I-35 through Iowa, you start to see these swine factory farms, and it's unbelievable the number of these operations. And so they're close to transportation. So they need to be close to major freeways and highways so that they can get those hogs to market. The other area where they're trying to build this up right now is I-29 through the Dakotas.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Sonia Trom-Ayers, who's authored a book called Dodge County, Inc., Big Ag and the Undoing of Rural America. The topic of factory farms is one very familiar to folks in our listening area on both sides of the river. And Sonia's been talking a little bit about the background of her farm, the beginning of these factory farms in southeast Minnesota and their rise and the reasons for that. This show airs, of course, at noon. So if folks are eating lunch, I apologize in advance, but one of the major issues you focus on here is manure management. And talk a little bit, Sonia, about how, the incredible amounts of manure that are produced and how that's disposed of and the consequences for people.
So these factory farms, I'm not sure that most people realize, but in these industrial operations, the hogs are raised above a manure pit, and there are slats. And if you drive through rural areas, some of you might notice there's a company called Hog Slat. And underneath that facility, and by the way, these facilities, they're all cookie cutter because they're just under the line for environmental review. So the cookie cutter is usually 2,400 hogs. And that manure pit is 8 feet deep. It's about, you know, imagine this building that's the size of a football field. And you've got a manure pit there that is 8 feet deep, holds an average of 1.1 million gallons of manure. And then each fall, and these are designed so that each fall, after you harvest your corn and beans, you're going to spread that manure on the land. And so they have, it's called pump out. So during pump out, because they're pumping the manure out of the building, into semis. So it goes into a semi, and then from there, the semi takes it to the field, and then there's a manure applicator that spreads it on the ground. Well, we've witnessed they'll apply the manure twice to the same land. A lot of the manure spreading occurs at night. You have no idea where and how much is being applied to the land. They'll spread it on frozen ground. The other thing to notice, if you've ever been out during manure spreading, there are gulls. So you'll see these gulls pecking at it. Or look at the vultures that are over some of these buildings, because you don't have a rendering truck that comes out to the farm anymore. They have composting stations. And so the dead pigs are piled up in these composting stations that are supposed to be covered up with wood chips or dirt or something. And then those dead bodies get spread on the ground too. So you're going to see gulls and vultures and so forth. Just take a look. That's what they're looking for, the dead bodies, all the dead body parts and so forth. It's disgusting.
You know, as I was reading this book, and I'm sure some of our listeners are going, thinking right now, will you know, did you fight this and how did you fight this? And talk a little bit about your efforts, but also, I mean, some of the tactics used against you, you described as mafia-like, and I'd have to agree, being one who watches a lot of mafia films. But you and your family and the supporters of trying to rein this in went through a lot, it sounds like.
We've had a hell of a time. But you have to know, I'm an attorney in Minneapolis. I practice family law. I'm a litigator. I'm in the courtroom. And the way that my parents fought this, so my parents received notice in April of 2014. My mother had just gone into the nursing home. And a few months later, my father received a notice, 10-day notice, that there was yet another swine factory farm going into the immediate area. This one was just a half mile west of our farm. And I will never forget that conversation. My dad called me. I was driving home from my office in downtown Minneapolis. And my dad and I were always very frank with one another and a little colorful language. But I'll never forget my father saying, enough is enough. And so I told him, Dad, I said, I'll help you out. And I found him legal counsel, because this is not my area. I helped him find an attorney, and they filed the first of three legal actions against Dodge County officials and local swine factory farm operators. So that's how they fought it. And we have faced tremendous harassment and intimidation as a result of, you know, taking action against the industry. So I'm happy to describe that if you're curious.
Well, no, I mean from well, no, you go ahead. I go ahead and talk about some of the harassment type things you faced and trying to stand up for your rights.
Well, almost immediately, garbage started to show up in our ditches. And it wasn't just in our road ditches, but it was also in our driveway. There were late night calls to my elderly father, who was in his 80s. And these would be calls, and they'd say, my father's name was Lowell. They'd say, Lowell, have you changed yet? Now imagine you're living on the farm where you were born, and someone's making this subtle threat to you. But there would be vehicles that would show up in the blue farm booties, because inside those facilities, they wear their gear. So they wear these blue farm booties. They took the blue farm booties and they planted farm booties about every 100 feet from the facility to our driveway, just a reminder that the industry was large and in charge. My brother and I were in the soybean field. We were pulling out some weeds, and a few hours later, there were bullet holes sprayed in the stop sign that was maybe 100, 200 feet away from where we had been pulling out the weeds. They've done all kinds of tactics. I think the most disgusting was the day of my father's, or the weekend of his funeral. My dad died in October of 2019, and it was during fall pump out. They were pumping out the manure, and they spread manure for 36 hours straight, the weekend of his visitation and funeral. And my brother walked into the funeral home. He had a bloody nose from, it's horrible, the methane, the hydrogen sulfide, the dangerous gases. And then the day of his funeral, as we stood graveside, because he's buried right, near the edge of town, you couldn't stand it. Like, several of my family members retreated and got in their cars because the stench was so bad. But I call it manure wars. But that's some of the nonsense. Oh, I'll give you another example. They make false telephone calls to the sheriff. And I faced the sheriff many times because they call the sheriff to report some false, some false report. Not to report some infraction, but to put the heat on me and get me to shut up. So there are other examples.
Yeah, I wasn't so much surprised they got involved and were able to control local government. Big corporations coming in and controlling local down to the township level. But what surprises me, may surprise some of our listeners, I mean, Minnesota is known as a more progressive state. And efforts, were there any efforts made at the state level when the Democrats, who were more progressive on especially environmental issues, to kind of rein in these factory farms?
Well, I'm not sure that some of the politicians truly understand the significance of what's been occurring in rural America, and on both sides of the aisle. And so, I can the Republicans, we testified a few years ago because they wanted to change our nuisance law here. And we across the United States, the industry has been extremely successful in passing right to farm bills, which basically puts the industry in a power position. And but for those of us who have been on our family farms for generations, what it does is it ties our hands. And so you cannot bring an action against the factory farm next door. But I think that I think the Democrats here probably have done a pretty good job with trying to control that. The other thing that's really important in Minnesota is local control. But trust me, the industry has found a way to try and ruin and take advantage of local control, to their advantage.
You say in the book that big ag encroachment was, quote, an underappreciated factor contributing to political realignment in rural America. I thought that was interesting. Can you expound on that just a little bit?
I think as a result of corporate agriculture, you know, big ag, essentially what we're seeing in these rural areas is hyper partisanship, because you have, there are two things that are working together for the industry. They have not only market power, but they also have political power. And they have cemented those two to gain an upper hand. You know, this is, they have a, there's a power imbalance, a huge power imbalance in rural America.
I've got time for, I got a couple minutes left here, but I want to give you plenty of time. What, and you know, I was reading your book, and I was, I had read the book by Sarah Vogel a while back, had her on the show, and that had a more positive ending to the challenges she faced. I never got that out of yours, unfortunately, and I don't want to give it away because I'd like readers to buy the book on their own. But you end the book up with some ideas and suggestions. Can you share some of those for folks that are concerned about this issue?
So, well, I think that what we're finding is that this is a struggle between community versus corporation. I think it's important for people to understand that community matters. This should be, quite honestly, and one of the things I'm seeing in other communities, because I'm aware of what's happening in another number of other communities, folks are getting together, liberals and conservatives, and they're not, you know, they're not coming on the, under the umbrella of Democrat or Republican. They're coming under the umbrella of, we're going to protect our community because community matters, and they're fighting the corporations. I mean, they realize we've had all of this significant hollowing out in rural communities, the loss of rural businesses, rural churches, consolidation of schools, schools that are turned into museums, and people are standing there and people are feeling powerless. So, but what can you do? Join an organization. There are a lot of organizations working on this. Talk to your neighbors, your friends. I think at the end of the day, we're all going to find out that we need one another. And so, but you don't have to buy the meat that is produced by Big Ag. You know, help out an independent farmer and rely on one another instead of, you know, going to the store. You don't have to buy that product that's produced by Big Ag.
It seems like we really need some stricter antitrust enforcement too, but it just doesn't seem to be coming to the degree we need. I think that's a major factor in trying to get Main Street back, reinvigorate Main Street.
Absolutely, but we're not going to see that for the next 4 years.
Sonia Tramares has been my guest today on Heartland Politics. She's the author of a book called Dodge County, Inc., Big Ag and the Undoing of Rural America, about the experiences of her family farm in Dodge County, Minnesota, not too far from the Iowa border. Sonia, thank you so much for being a guest today on Heartland Politics.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.